Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Monday, April 22nd, day 199 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel Dan here with our diplomatic correspondent, Laser Berman, on this Passover Eve. Hi, Laser. Chag Sameach.
Hi, Amanda. Chag Sameach.
We will continue the discussion of the potential U.S. sanctions on an IDF unit and where the U.S. has used similar sanctions in the past. In light of a campus rabbi telling students to stay home, we'll hear about increased overt anti-Semitism at Columbia University in New York. As Jews around the world observe Passover this evening, there are still over 100 hostages in Gaza. Laser will weigh in. All this and more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Following days of unrest and anti-Israel action at Columbia University in New York City, following a week in which its president testified before a congressional hearing, the university's Orthodox rabbi sent a message to Jewish students urging them to stay away from campus until it's deemed safe again. Following his letter, Columbia University agreed to allow students to attend classes remotely, according to messages that were sent in pro-Israel student groups, and housing was offered with faculty as needed. This situation has spiraled so out of control that Israeli President Isaac Herzog and U.S. President Joe Biden are even weighing in. Laser, what are you seeing?
What I'm seeing are images that I think many people thought would be unimaginable, especially on the elite colleges in the U.S., on these campuses that are supposed to be the intellectual and in some ways even the moral elite of the American education system. But what we are seeing in recent days is even more extreme than what we've seen on Columbia's campus since October 7th. These are protests that openly praise Hamas, that say we are all Hamas, that call for more repeated 1,000 times October 7th, really open support for Hamas, the open, blatant anti-Semitism against Jewish students, telling them to go back to Europe, cursing at them. And it's really no surprise that Jewish students really do not feel safe. They feel frustrated. They feel like they are not being heard. They have been raising the alarm for up to 6 months now, and it seems like the situation continues to get worse on Columbia. And obviously, we've heard the situation has been similar, though not as extreme, on other Ivy League campuses. When you have the president of Israel and the United States weighing in, you know that the situation has reached a certain level that really something fundamental needs to change. And the question is, what will change? I think universities recognize that there's a problem, especially after the catastrophic testimony of the three college presidents in front of Congress, two of which lost their jobs. But the universities still seem unsure of how to get a handle on the problem. And there's also a question whether there will be a change amongst American Jews and whether they will start looking at other options for colleges, whether, you know, obviously it's been a place where Jews have sent kids in high numbers, and it's been an aspiration for kids to go to Ivy League institutions. But certainly if they can't feel safe and they can't openly support Israel. They can't express their love for Israel, and in some cases, even be identifiably Jewish and feel safe, then maybe it's time to think differently about where they send their kids. So this is certainly something that is dramatic, and we're really going to have to see a different approach and a much more concerted approach to making sure that Jewish students feel safe on campus and are safe on campus, because what has been done clearly is not enough. Columbia is just one example, but I think it's the most obvious and extreme one right now.
Campuses are, of course, a microcosm of society, and perhaps things are exacerbated because it is a bit of a hothouse for all types of societal concerns. Laser, you are currently in the United States. Are you feeling any kind of change in terms of the general attitude against Jews?
So I wouldn't say that campuses are necessarily a microcosm of society. They've always been a place that attracts some extreme ideas and, it skews way, way younger and than general society and people with less experience and certainly people that are wealthier. So I don't think it's a microcosm, but it certainly does reflect and certainly foreshadows some trends in society, many of which are not especially healthy or encouraging. I don't think I'm in a position to comment on what the general situation is toward Jews, but I can say something about the way I've noticed that Jews have been reacting, because I have been in a number of Jewish communities over the past couple of weeks, Long Island, New Jersey, D.C., Minnesota, Chicago, Providence, Rhode Island. I'm certainly struck by the level of attention and care that and knowledge that Jews who I speak to have about the war and everything that's going on, and the questions that they have are really very specific, and you can see how much they care and their worry. But I think it's outside of the communities where there's really been maybe even a broader change. I think it kind of reminds me of Herzl's experience seeing the after effects of the or what was going on in Paris around the Dreyfus trial, where Jews who thought they could basically not identify in any real sense as Jews, as their main marker of identity, realized that that's really impossible, that no matter what, they will be forced in some ways to identify as Jews and in ways that make them rethink their whole connection to Judaism. And you see people coming back to synagogues, being much more concerned about anti-Semitism. And I think in realizing that Jewish position and Jewish power, quote unquote, can disappear in an instance. You know, obviously, we know about what happened to the Jews in the 1920s and 30s in Nazi Germany, where they really had reached the apex of a lot of the key markers and the key sources of power in German life. And then that all can disappear in a minute. I think many of those, I'm not saying it's the same situation, but that fear that it could all be gone very quickly is, I think, a fear that many Jews are starting to feel. I'm not saying the situation is at all comparable, but those same feelings are there. And I think many Jews who are not affiliated in the past with Israel or with the Jewish community are really rethinking that and are really waking up to what anti-Semitism is and what it means for their own lives.
And of course, one of the major differences between the 1930 Jewry and what Herzl saw is that there is a state of Israel, but that relationship can be complicated. Two U.S. sources told the Times of Israel yesterday that in addition to the Netzach Yehuda Battalion, which the Biden administration is slated to designate this week for sanctions, Washington is reportedly considering more sanctions against other Israeli military and police units that are alleged to have committed human rights violations against Palestinians. Now, the U.S. has used similar threats against other countries' militaries in the past, as I understand it, through this 1997 Lehi law. So, Laser, first of all, can you explain this law and how it can be applied?
Sure. So Senator Pat Leahy, who until last year was the senior senator from Vermont to the left side of the Democratic caucus, had pushed this law in the 90s when the U.S. was backing Colombia against drug cartels, and there was real concerns about human rights abuses from the Colombian police and military. He attached basically two provisions. One, limiting the foreign assistance that the State Department gives in terms of countries that are suspected of human rights, and another one that is similar, but for the Defense Department, Department of Defense. And that has been used over the years to review units, individuals that are receiving training, especially funding and weapons from the United States. And those countries are generally countries that are not especially, they're not really seen as protectors of human rights. So that include Colombia, as I said, Nigeria, Turkey, Indonesia, Mexico. But also it has been used as a warning against Australia, where there were Australian Special Forces troops who, over the course of several years in Afghanistan, based on an Australian review, had killed, I believe it was 39 Afghani civilians, and had even planted weapons at the scene to make it seem like they were terrorists. And in the end, because I believe there was one soldier who was ultimately punished, and there was a review from the Australian government, a pretty fundamental review, that threat never resulted in any meaningful sanctions. But it has been used against a democratic country in the past. But these are for really gross human rights violations, things like murder, kidnapping, torture, and rape. So this is really something quite dramatic. And if you think, you know, as we're talking about in Colombia, but where Israel is in terms of the world, and it's facing genocide accusations in The Hague, this is really disastrous for that. And I think there's no question it's going to go and continue on to other units. I think, you know, just talk about Golani could be next, but you're just going to see a wave, I believe, of an attempts to use this to punish other IDF combat units, not only in the West Bank, but we're going to see it potentially used in Gaza. And it can really get in the way of the relationship. But as we've seen, when America takes, you know, one step, you'll see countries in Europe and then, you know, international human rights organizations go much, much further. So I think this is the start of another very problematic chapter. And the fact that it's coming now, you know, after Iran got involved directly in the war, and we still have hostages with no clear way to get them out of Gaza, and the ground operation has lost its momentum as well. This is just terrible timing for Israel on all levels.
Now, there was a conversation last night between Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. And interestingly, in the readout from the U.S. side, this whole issue of the sanctions was not mentioned. Can one take that as a sign that perhaps they won't go through?
Listen, what we're hearing now is, you know, anonymous sources, even though, you know, the initial reporting from Axios, you know, has been from a reporter who's been really well plugged in the past. So there is certainly room for this not to happen. And that's certainly a full court press from Israel at the time. I wouldn't read too much into that readout. I don't think there's a lot of benefit for the U.S. to start, you know, putting even more fuel onto this potential fire. So there's certainly pressure from within the State Department and from key places within the Biden administration to increase the pressure on Israel. Again, we've talked about this in the past. These are people, there are some individuals who really are quite critical of Israel, certainly in the Gaza Strip. And also, let's not forget, you know, that election is getting closer and closer, and everything needs to be seen, I think, within that context. And I would add one more point. The Biden administration has been accusing IDF soldiers basically of war crimes, not directly, but in certain statements he's made, you know, for months when he's talked about indiscriminate bombing, carpet bombing, and things like that. Those are, you know, that is a green light, whether it's intentional or not, but other organizations and other countries take that and move it further. It is really a problem. And right now, you know, Hamas is still intact in the Gaza Strip. They're still intact in Rafah. The biggest obstacle to continuing that operation and destroying the last Hamas units in the Gaza Strip is the Biden administration. That is the reason why Israel is not moving forward on this. And I think that needs to be taken into account as we assess the relationship and assess the benefits and the drawbacks of what the Biden administration has done since October 7th.
We'll go to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war. You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. In a pre-Passover video, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel would, quote, land additional and painful blows on Hamas over the holiday to increase pressure on the terror group to free the hostages it has held in the Gaza Strip for over 6 months. We've discussed on the podcast in the recent past about the prioritization of the government war versus hostages and how this has affected their release. And hostage negotiators have been unable to recreate their efforts in November when they struck a week-long ceasefire deal that saw the release of 105 hostages in return for Israel releasing some 240 Palestinian security prisoners. So I wonder if you have thoughts, Laser, about what has been more effective in achieving any releases so far, military or diplomatic pressure? What is currently missing, essentially, to strike a deal?
Sure. I think we should remember what the situation was in November when Hamas actually agreed to a deal. The IDF operation in the Gaza Strip was at its height. You had, at the time, four divisions, I believe, in the Gaza Strip. The reservists were called up, and the IDF operation was about to even expand even further. So there was real military pressure on Hamas and on its leadership. At the same time, the statements from Israel's friends in the world, from the U.S. And in Europe, were much, much more supportive. There was much less daylight between the countries and Israel. So there was less room for Hamas to see, you know, an opportunity to play with that support. And there was less reason to play for time. There was also not the domestic marches and real protests against Netanyahu, especially around his handling of the hostage situation. So there was Israeli society was seen as much more unified. Now, everything has been undermined. If I'm Yahya Sinwar sitting in some tunnel near Rafiah, I understand that I have survived the actual war. The war is over. Right, Israel's not fighting a war anymore. We have one brigade in the Gaza Strip from a height of 28. He feels like he's going to survive the military campaign. It's really unclear that the IDF will even reach Rafah because, you know, the Americans have been so unconvinced and have been so adamant and increasingly adamant against Israel's ability to evacuate civilians in a sufficient fashion. The more time that goes by, Hamas understands that the more pressure is being applied to Israel in terms of calls for a ceasefire that are not conditioned on a hostage release. Almost no one is talking about the military defeat of Hamas anymore. And then I think these protests against Netanyahu are also undermining Israel's position there as well. The call is for to bring them home now, putting the onus on Israel's government where it should be, I think. Let them out. Let my people go. Putting the onus on Hamas and reminding everyone that the ones that hold them and the ones that can make the decisions here are Hamas. So at every level, Israel's position has eroded. And you can see that by Hamas's reactions, that they just don't see any reason to be more flexible, to make any sort of compromise. What you see is the more they wait, the more pressure there is from the U.S. to get Israel to make more and more compromises without getting anything from Hamas. So I think, you know, it's pretty obvious that in negotiations, when you see that time is on your side, there's no reason to make any concessions. And that dynamic really needs to change. I don't think it's going to change from the public relationship between Israel and the U.S., from the Biden administration, Netanyahu, especially what we've heard in the past couple of days about new pressure being applied. So the only real thing that can change that is the Rafah operation itself. But the Israel's government, the Netanyahu government, is really not able to at this point to come get to any sort of common ground with the Biden administration that will allow that to happen. So things are really stuck, and Hamas sees that. And I think the more Israel's public puts the, you know, just kind of puts the blame on Netanyahu in many reasons, you know, as a political ploy to get him out of office, it only further undermines Israel's ability to get hostages out.
I would just like to note, it's not as if you're supporting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu personally. What you're saying is, from an analytical point of view, the appearance of his lack of support here in Israel is what perhaps could be also leading to the lack of leverage in getting the hostages out. Am I reading that correctly, Lazar?
Yeah, I mean, I've been critical of Netanyahu on many things, including the humanitarian aid, the pace of the ground operation. We're 6 months in and we've achieved none of the goals. But on the hostage negotiations, I certainly am not sympathetic to the idea that it should have been the hostages as the clear prime goal, even if that means that Hamas will win the war itself. I think the Israeli public would not support that, certainly wouldn't have supported it in the early days. And I think these the current demonstrations are, I understand the families, but the current demonstrations are not doing anything for Israel's ability to apply pressure for Hamas. I'm sure there are people that disagree with me, but I think it's very clear that it's not doing any favors. And I think that needs to be recognized.
We are, of course, celebrating the Passover Seder tonight. And one of the themes is, of course, the 10 plagues. And the last one is the slaughtering of the firstborn. And it is such cruel and unusual punishment. And yet, at the same time, this was the leverage that allowed the people to go, let my people go. It allowed the Hebrews to leave. And I think everyone struggles with the idea of death during the war, but it seems that it's been charted out throughout history that it is inevitable. Do you see then that an increased military operation in Gaza is the only way to get the people out?
Well, let's think about the alternatives. Is Hamas just going to let them go because they have a change of heart or change of ideology? No. Is there going to be some sort of diplomatic pressure meaningfully applied from Qatar and Egypt that'll get them out? I think unlikely. So really the only thing that would be able to work is something to drastically change Hamas's calculus, and that would be the personal survival of the leadership, including Sinwar, and the survival of the organization. Right now, those are not in danger because Israel's not even, you know, showing that it's close to an operation. As long as they believe that they can survive, they will continue to hold out. So I think that the military operation is the last card that Israel has. If that doesn't work, then I think they're really out of options. But this is the last card to be played, and it needs to be played right. But it actually needs to move forward, and it needs to move forward soon. The longer Israel waits, as we get toward the conventions in the U.S. in the summer, it just gets harder and harder. So this is the time to do it.
Let us hope that Pharaoh Sinwar's heart will no longer be hardened and our people will rejoin us soon. Lazar, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach to you. And I think we're all praying, and we'll all be at our seders, either marking, doing something physical to remind us of the hostages that are still in the Gaza Strip. And we'll be thinking about them and thinking what freedom means this year in a more poignant fashion than it has in years past.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another special installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.